Lloyd, thank you very much for giving us of your time to come on the program, the Green Planet program. As a theologian with many, many years' experience here in New Zealand, could you tell us, or the audience, how you came about to look at your new subject of the greening of spirituality?
Well, I think it's mainly because I became increasingly aware of all the information we've been receiving during the latter part of the 20th century, that I came to the conclusion that we actually face a very serious crisis, and it has been coming upon us slowly without our realizing it. And the reasons for the crisis I'll mention shortly, but the trouble is that most people live within a fairly confined horizon of interests, and consequently, the number of people who see the crisis coming is relatively few. Now, that makes it very difficult for us to have any sort of turnaround. Now, I come to it, as you say, from a more theological angle, and it will be surprising to many Christians to find that Christianity has actually been blamed for the crisis. Now, that's an overstatement, of course, but the reason why that came about was that the Christian West, which largely was responsible for bringing the modern world into being, long believed, and it was taught in the Bible, that God created the world for humankind and then placed humankind in a position of domination over the world and was, as it were, free to subdue the world and use it for its own sake. Now, while we were relatively weak in numbers, that didn't matter at all. But once we expanded in the way we did in the 20th century, I mean, human population quadrupled in the 20th century, and we began to make demands upon nature that humans had never done before. Consequently, insofar as it was the Christian tradition which gave to people this view that they were there to dominate the world, there's a certain truth in the fact that Christianity can be blamed for it. Now, Christians quite rightly try to counter this kind of charge by saying, yes, but God placed us in as stewards over the world. And there's some truth in that. But if so, we are not being very good stewards. We are exploiting the resources of the earth beyond their capacity to supply them. And we have, and by our multiplication of population, we are now outreaching what nature itself can provide for us. Now, during the 20th century, we also came to have a much better view of how much we depend upon nature. You see, one of the troubles again is that the great religious traditions of the world, all of which began about 2,500 years ago, tended to bypass what had long been human interests. Human interests originally were in nature, and they thought nature consisted of powerful divine forces which did everything. Those divine forces, or gods or spirits, were set aside about 2,500 years ago. I'm speaking very broadly at this stage. And from that time onwards, and it was very true in the Christian tradition, we came to play down the importance of nature and saw ourselves as much more important. And this is much worse today than it used to be, simply because in the last 100 years, the number of people living in cities has actually increased from just a few percent to 50% of people live now in cities, which means that they are cut off from nature. And children think that that milk comes in a bottle, for example, or a packet. And many people have little feeling for the natural world. And consequently, this is one of the problems we face in trying to spread the appreciation of the natural world with which you made your opening remarks.
So, how do we get back to nature using the our spiritual intuition, or
First of all, we have a very big problem in education, and one of the helpful signs is that in education, as we have it here in the Western world, there are some encouraging signs that younger people are being encouraged to understand and appreciate the importance of the natural world, but time is not on our side. The crisis is actually coming at a very fast rate, and it needs an educative process to speed up, as it were. And I'm only talking here of the Western world. What about vast countries, say the various countries of Africa? Now, they are so hard pressed that you can't expect too much from them. Their main concerns are knowing where the next meal is going to come from. And this is because the population expansion in Africa is simply enormous, and that Africa at the moment is not able really to feed itself. And while it is claimed that the world can produce enough food for everybody, the point is we can't distribute it, for the simple reason that there are such inequalities between the rich nations and the poor nations. So things are getting worse and worse by the minute, and that's why it's so alarming.
And so the World Council of Churches, say, just from a Christian point of view,
I think the World Council of Churches is concerned with it and has done its best, but the World Council of Churches is a very weak body compared with what it was even when it got started, simply because the churches themselves are declining institutions in the Western world. They're not so much in the Africa world, but in Africa they're very conservative, and the churches, on the whole, have not really been able to keep up with the rapid changing character, both of culture and of the various challenges that we face. And this, another example of this is the way in which we have the most powerful nation of the world, the United States, the richest nation in the world, really quite opposed to the sort of things that you and I are concerned with. Bush was really put back. The Bush administration is largely dependent upon middle America, which is almost completely fundamentalist, and has no interest whatsoever in the kind of things that we're talking about this morning. Indeed, it's more concerned to make sure it keeps its own high level of living, that is why, and really, it's basically concerned to enter Iraq to preserve the sources of oil that it really depends upon. So we have some very serious problems here.
Well, I know that indigenous peoples have got an affinity to the land, and I've heard with Buddhists, they too have more of a affinity to nature. Do you find that your statement?
Buddhists?
Yes.
Yes. Well, first of all, let's take Japan. In its pre-Buddhist tradition of Shinto. Now, Shinto preserves a great deal of the respect and honor of natural forces, and that is why the Japanese have a feel for nature that has largely been lost in the Western world. Now, Buddhism, of course, did not originate in Japan, but spread to it. But Buddhism itself was not originally concerned with the natural world. It was concerned with how to find a satisfactory life form for itself. But I think it is true that the Buddhist world is not so committed to the domination of nature that the Western world has been, and consequently would be more open to respond positively to the sorts of things we're concerned about in conservation.
Yes, all the large sort of groups are in some ways quite conservative. The American Indians always used to talk about Great Spirit, and many of them could put their arms around a tree and re-energize by aligning or tuning to the tree's energies.
Oh, yes. Well, you see, the North American Indian is a very good example of indigenous peoples everywhere, including, of course, our own Maori people, who have preserved a culture which really belongs to the period before the great religious traditions emerged, what I call the axial period, 2,500 years ago. And consequently, Maori people have a much greater feel for the land and for life forces than we Westerners do. And I think, so far as New Zealand is concerned, we need to build on that, as we are attempting to do to some extent. The American Indians have, and indeed indigenous peoples elsewhere, have something to teach us in that respect. That is where spirituality today has to go back to its original forms, not necessarily abandoning what has happened in the meantime, because what has happened in the meantime has been the growth of a good deal of morality and concern for human justice and fairness and the qualities of compassion and love. They also are very important, but we need to blend those with the ultimate respect for the natural world upon which the future of humankind completely depends.
With, say, pantheism and paganism, or where people go out and they may swim in lakes or rivers and sort of smell flowers and then align with the moon, etc., and they plant with the moon, do you feel that... how are we going to find ways in which to let people, particularly, say, in the West, because we are the ones who are the dominant ideology from the standpoint of industrialization and the attendant pollution, how do you think that we ordinary, say, New Zealanders in this case, can affiliate with the land and then bring about change within local government and government?
Well, I think we have to recover, first of all, the respect for nature and recognize that we are all part of it. You see, once again, the Christian tradition has led us astray to some extent in teaching us that we are not part of nature. What has, and indeed the whole story of creation as it was originally understood, suggests that. But we are all part of life, of planetary life. And one of the good things that has come out of, say, Darwin's theory of evolution is the recognition that we are related, and now we know by our DNA, we are related to every aspect, every living form here on the planet. And we must see ourselves as part of it, with the added advantage that we are able, by our consciousness and our brain power, to think about it. And that places us in a position of great responsibility towards it. Now, the more we come to realize this, the more we'll go out into the natural world and get the feel for it. Indeed, it would be wonderful if all of us who live in cities could have the opportunity to spend some time every year out in the country, not just playing sports and skiing. That's all very nice, but just getting the feel of the natural world. And, of course, the first person in the Western world who really led this was St. Francis. And that's why he's regarded as the sort of patron saint of all conservationists today. He taught us to regard the sun and the moon as our brothers and sisters, and to see the plants and the birds and so on as all part of a living whole. And as the new discipline of ecology has been teaching us, and all living forms are interdependent. So our life depends upon all other forms, from the very loveliest micro forms of life right up to the larger ones like ourselves. And that is why all the one-issue movements such as Save the Whales and Save the Blue-Eyed Penguin and so on, they're all very important in their way, because they help to draw attention to the fact that their continued existence is something that we ourselves are actually dependent upon, because all life is interdependent.
Well, we are in the garden, are we not? This is really profound, because of Judaism, Christianity and Islam talk about we fell out of the garden, and now we're still in a beautiful garden, and we're fouling that as well. It seems a very strange.
Well, yes, because rapid forms of consumption of the earth's resources has caused us to bring about a tremendous amount of pollution. Now, we're not only polluting the natural forces, but the two most basic things on which we depend, which are air and water, are going to be in short supply. Water, particularly in the future, and with our cities and the use of oil, we have been polluting the atmosphere, so that actually the air in some cities, Tokyo is a very good example, is really not fit to breathe. And we have to face some very big turnarounds. But how is that going to happen? Well, not easily, because all our international affairs tend to be dominated by questions of economics. And current economic theory uses growth as its great measure. Now, the point is that, as the Club of Rome said some 20, 30 years ago, there are limits to how we can grow. And we who live in the Western world and who have a very high standard of living are most unwilling to go down in the standard of living in order first of all to overcome such things as pollution and to husband more carefully the natural non-renewable resources, and also to share with the vast numbers of people who are much worse off and who have barely than the what they need, the essentials for life. So this is why I feel that it's going to be exceedingly difficult to meet the crisis that's ahead of us.
Yes, no political party actually wants to lead on this one, because they don't want to get out of power next election.
No, that's the problem. And I think the Green Party, and of course it's a worldwide kind of movement. It's not just in New Zealand. The Green Party has a lot to be said for it, in that it keeps drawing our attention to these needs, and it's an important to be to carry out a leavening process in the whole political system. And I think we should give them all support.
Lloyd, you have been on Earth for some time. A lot of people, of course, like myself, have been here in my mid-50s, and we've seen a lot of change. And, of course, you've really witnessed this change. And as an elder, a civic elder, you would look around and see some of your friends and other people the same age, either retired or possibly still in power. How do you get to them? Because in many cases, grassroots has been one way to bring about change, but if we could get somebody right at the apex of the pyramid who can then shape policy and send this information down to the masses, we might be able to instigate change. Have you any ideas on that?
Change is coming, but all too slowly. As you say, I have witnessed a tremendous amount of change in my lifetime. In fact, not only have I changed myself, but I've changed myself only because I've been responding to the changes taking place around me. And I have tried to express this to people and to write about it. Indeed, the book I wrote in 1999, The World to Come, tried to show that the 20th century was actually a turning point in the whole history of humankind and also a turning point really on this planet. Because up until the beginning of the 20th century, and it was still very much alive when I was young, the world seemed to be one's oyster. We were expanding. There were wonderful things to be done. But during the 20th century, we reached limits. It's rather symbolized by the way in which Mount Everest was at last conquered, and the Antarctica, and so on. There are no new geographical places to explore, and we are being thrown back on ourselves and realizing the limits within which we have to live. But this is being recognized far too slowly by people, and as new generations come, they at first don't have the advantage of having experienced this change as I have, and which I feel so deeply. We've come to the end, for example, of the Christian era. I tried to say that in that book that I referred to. Indeed, I suggested that the year 2000 really should have been renamed. It should have been the year one of the global era, in which we, because all nations and all humankind now have a common future, or they have no future at all. And so, globalization, in my view, is little to do with economics. So it has a sort of economic offshoot, but globalization means that as a human race, we now have to learn to live together. And we have to live in harmony with the planet, and we have to learn to live in harmony with one another. And that's the big challenge.
The idea of global family and allowing everybody to realize that we share the same invisible, powerful breath.
Yes.
Is definitely one way. I've heard it called the holy breath.
Yes.
And I think that's a wonderful way. And in India, of course, the word namaste, which means I honour the light behind your eyes, I honour the God within you, and which when they see somebody, they say namaste, and when they say goodbye, they say namaste, which is a wonderful way of telling each other that we are connected. Possibly we need another way to be able to express our common inheritance or our common future.
Well, I think what I think that needs to be done is to draw from our cultural and religious past, but express it in forms which are appropriate to the age in which we now live. No culture ever actually starts from scratch. It always grows out of what has preceded it. And I was interested you used the term holy breath, because that is a word that has long been there in Christian tradition, but where it was called Holy Spirit. Because spirit is, in the ancient languages, spirit and breath were the same word, you see. And so whether you call it air or breath or spirit, you are talking about the same thing. And what we, as you rightly say, we all breathe the same air, and at the same, and that can be a kind of symbol, as it were, of the fact that we all have to be brought together in the same kind of spirit of understanding, of love, of honesty, of concern for justice, and all those things. Now, there are some hopeful signs. It's just that they're not coming fast enough.
You said you have changed, and this change you've experienced, it's invigorated you. And when I listen to you, you definitely have a feel for the new. Can you tell us a little about your renewal or this revitalization process that you've gone through to embrace the new?
Well, to do that is quite a long story, I suppose, but let me do it very briefly. You see, let me go back to my young days. I wasn't brought up in the church. I wasn't brought up as a Christian at all. I belonged to one of the non-church families, you know. And it was only at university that I got caught up in the Christian tradition. And what it did for me was to give me a sort of framework within to which to find meaning in my life. And that's why I've been grateful for the Christian tradition ever since. But as I came into it, and eventually, of course, became a minister and then a theological teacher and so on, I kept drawing upon it, but at the same time using it to develop a way of life that took into account all the new things that were happening in the 20th century. And I think Christianity can do that. Indeed, any great religious tradition can do that. But the trouble with Christianity, to a great extent, it has become bogged down in something static and unchangeable, and finds it very difficult to move out of it. And I suppose that's the same with Islam too. And that's why there's a big backlash today, which we call fundamentalism, which is the attempt to return to the past where they felt safe and secure, whereas religious traditions, to be alive, must always be changing. Well, I've tried to do that in my own small way, of course, and to help people to do the same, not with a small amount of success, nothing wonderful really, but that's my response to your question of how I've tried to deal with change.
By embracing new technologies or new ideas, quantum theory has been brought into a lot of people's attention lately, and the fact is that theoretically telepathy can be connected right across the planet, with particularly with possibly mums losing a daughter or a son on the other side of the planet, they instantly know. And I wish to know, in your cosmology, are miracles possible?
Well, it depends upon how you define miracles. If you're thinking of wonderful things, which is what the word miracle means, they're happening all the time. But if you think of miracle as a suspension of natural law caused by a divine force, no, I don't think those sort of miracles happen at all. What has happened with the advent of quantum physics is that it has surpassed the old Newtonian physics, which saw everything determined by cause and effect, so that if you knew everything, you could actually foretell the future. But what quantum physics has shown is that right in the basic stuff of the universe, there is in fact uncertainty. And it is because of that uncertainty there that you cannot foretell the future, that it has made it possible for the phenomenon of free will to emerge in the human condition, in that we cannot determine what a person can do, because that person has, however small, an element of choice and free will. Now, some scientists have tried to see a connection between that degree of uncertainty at the very basic level in physical phenomena and the exercise of free will in the human condition as we experience it. I think that's what you were referring to.
I was looking at Gaia theory, that possibly with the realization that our planet is an organism, and then the potential within the human species that Rupert Sheldrake feels that we could possibly shape our future by collectively thinking a positive solution, and then the mass of humanity utilizing quantum theory can essentially build up to a critical mass of energy to bring through a new thought pattern, a new way of life.
Yes, I think that's a kind of view that we have to keep ourselves open to. The Gaia theory, just forgotten the name of the man.
Lovelock? James Lovelock?
James, yes. And I think that's an excellent theory, and particularly it sets before us a model that we can grasp in our minds of the Earth as a living complex organism of which all living species are contributing parts, and that just as millions of cells work in our own bodies for the good of the body as a whole, so there's a sense in which all species on Earth are like those cells, contributing to the life of the planet as a whole. And he suggested, of course, that the planet, in some strange ways, has a kind of inbuilt immune system, so that if one species gets out of hand, as the human species may well get out of hand, the planet has a way of just getting rid of us, because we're a danger to planetary life as a whole. Now, that's one aspect of that. The other one that you mentioned with Rupert Sheldrake is that, and this is something which Teilhard de Chardin actually hinted at way back in the middle of the 20th century when he wrote his book, The Phenomenon of Man, and namely that we have reached the point in globalization, he didn't use that word, but he really was talking about the same thing, that we're in coming together. There's a sense in which the interrelationship between human minds produces a kind of universal human consciousness, which he, of course, thought of as God, and that in spite of all our fears, as I am expressing them quite strongly here this morning, in spite of all our fears, yet there can come out of this present stage of uncertainty and fear as to what's going to happen a sort of more wonderful climax than we can actually imagine.
Yes, he called it the noosphere, like the mind.
Yeah, I'd call it the noosphere, yes.
Yes, it's like at heart, if humanity could come together and become sort of a global group mind, we can bring about change.
That's right, yes. And when one sees how when the time for an idea has come, how it can spread so rapidly, that gives some encouragement to us that if we can learn to express it in the right possible way, it can spread like wildfire around the planet and bring people together into a spirit of unity. Now, that's the sort of thing we need to be hoping for, I think.
Some people, a woman called Barbara Marx Hubbard, talks about humanity, we're subconsciously or unconsciously causing a crisis, so that this crisis will be the evolutionary driver that forces us to confront ourselves and push us up to another level of being.
Yes.
And it's pretty profound.
Yes, it sounds a little airy-fairy to begin with, but it's the sort of thing we shouldn't just push aside completely. One of the troubles is that we have so little understanding of how the human unconscious works. I think in this respect, Jung did a great deal more than Freud in helping us to understand the creative character of the human unconscious. I mean, it's we see it at its best in its dreams, because they occur when we are unconscious, and all our ideas, which we think that we've thought up of ourselves, actually originate in the unconscious. So it is possible that the collective unconscious, mind you, I think Jung had his own sort of rather peculiar way of understanding the collective unconscious, but if we can use it in a more general way to refer to the unconscious of all human beings, then it is conceivable that can bring about some quite dramatic change in the human future.
What would you suggest we do here in New Zealand, Lloyd, to mobilise people's awareness?
Well, I would think we should show our support for every move and every pronouncement that comes from whatever source, which promotes conservation of natural resources, careful stewardship of non-renewable resources. I think we should be on the side, for example, of solar heating, of wind creation of power. We should be on the side of cutting down our dependence upon oil. We should be on the side of recycling everything that is possible, of reducing our waste, and being willing to lower our material standard of living in order to bring about some of these results.
And is there anything through non-physical? I mean, prayer and meditation, those are little things for us
to do. Think whatever religious tradition or spirituality one may find oneself most at home in, one should direct towards these issues. That's why my little book, The Greening of Christianity, was an attempt to show how and why the Christian tradition itself should direct its attention to these issues. And I drew attention in that book to the way in which all the Christian festivals actually originated as nature festivals. Christmas originated as the celebration of the winter solstice. Of course, it doesn't work here because we have it in the summer. But the main Christian festival of Easter originated as the spring festival. Once again, it doesn't work here because it's in originated in acknowledging something that was happening that was important in nature. And it was the spring festival that that gave rise to the whole idea of resurrection, because in the springtime in the northern hemisphere, particularly because most trees were deciduous there, everything seemed to come alive again out of the death of winter. And we need to restore this element in the way in which Christianity is celebrated.
Lloyd, could you finish? We've only got a few more moments now, with maybe just a little pearl of wisdom or some little insight that came to you over the course of your life.
I would think the older I've got, the more I stand in awe of just the universe itself. I think that from my earliest years, I, as I used to look out on a starry sky at night, I just was completely awestruck as I learned more and more of the Milky Way and the distant nebulae and of the time expansion of the universe. And everything that I have learned during the course of my life has actually been to simply increase this feeling of wonder and wonder of life. I just saw a television program last night on the National Geographic Channel, which was a very good explanation of how life evolved and how we are as today is because of a long series of mutations and changes. Life is always changing, and that's a wonderful thing in itself. So I think glory in life, glory in the world, and in the cosmos. It's just awe-inspiring.